Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Friday, April 13th. Friday the 13th again? How often are we going to have those things? Anyway, not that it means anything, but so it's Friday, April 13th, 2012, and this is podcast 132. Yesterday, if you happen to get by the BadQuaker.com website, you would have noticed that, let me get over there to it. We put up a another YouTube video called Rent Seeking and Wealth Destruction. You can find that on the Bad Quaker website, or you can go over to YouTube. The best way to get to it, because I have a hard time finding the Bad Quaker YouTube site if I'm not logged in. It's for some reason I've tried searching in different ways, and it doesn't come up readily. But so the best way to get to it is just to go to badquaker.com and look on the page there for the YouTube video, and then you can go to YouTube from there and subscribe to badquaker.com videos. I don't know if we'll do a lot of those, but we'll definitely try to do one every now and then. We've done a couple of them now, and we've put a couple of the podcasts up as YouTube videos, which is a little strange for me because, you know, I have a hard time, for me, I have a hard time going to YouTube and sitting there and with an hour-long YouTube video unless it's something that's has a lot of interesting visuals with it. Like, for instance, watching the Freedom Fiends video, Guns and Weed. Now, that's a really good video. I think it's like 90 minutes long or something, and maybe closer to 100 minutes long. I'm not sure, but it's very enjoyable, and it's the whole thing's available for free, and I had no problem sitting through that. And the Waco Rules of Engagement, now that's a really good video, and I have no problem sitting through that. But most YouTube videos, you know, that's my problem with like the Thrive thing and the Wizard and the Secret of Oz and stuff. Unless I'm really interested in the thing, I can't. I have a hard time sitting there for a whole hour. There's so many other things that I need to do. Even watching something I enjoy, like the Guns and Weed video, spending that kind of time, I end up feeling guilty that I'm sitting there enjoying a good video and not, you know, working in the garden or mowing the lawn or working on the motorhome or recording a podcast or researching something or, you know, so I don't know. But evidently, you know, people are watching the, well, I don't know if you watch a video of a podcast or not, but we do have a couple of the podcasts. They're an hour long. One is the interview with Mike Shanklin. And there's not really a lot to see. We try to put a couple different pictures for you to look at, but mostly it's just an excuse to get the podcast put up there and try to get it out to more people. The other articles, the audio articles that we put over there on YouTube actually have some video entertainment to them because we tried to match pictures. We try to change the visuals as it goes through and match pictures to the topic at hand as the discussion goes in the video. So in the articles, so those we've tried to make somewhat entertaining so that they, and they're only running, I think, like 10 or 11 minutes long. That's kind of long for a YouTube video. I think research has shown what the guys from The Who said back in the 60s, which was, you know, all good entertainment is between 2 minutes and 2 minutes 30 seconds. I think Pete Townsend actually said that. So he kind of, was reiterating a formula that some people already understood, but he was saying it out in the public where most people in the public eye weren't saying it openly, that the average person's attention is about 2 minutes to 2.5 minutes long. So I think that's why the most successful YouTube videos are right in that time frame. And that's why most news stories are within that time frame too. As a matter of fact, and this is probably why that's on my mind, Nima Vedati over at the Freedom Fiends mentioned that when he worked in the news in a newsroom, that they like to keep their news videos at around 2 minutes, because that's where most people's attention span lies. And that means that if you're listening intentionally to this podcast right now, which has already gone on over 6 minutes, you're not normal. And that's good. Okay, so maybe this might be a good time for me to actually get on a topic and talk about something that I was going to talk about. I think I did do the introduction where I said the date and the which podcast this is. I don't know if I introduced myself. This is kind of late in the podcast to do so. I apologize for that. My name is Ben Stone, and this is the Bad Quaker podcast. You can see, you can find old podcasts, and you can find the YouTube videos, and you can find everything else that we have to offer at badquaker.com. And in case you didn't know, we're on the Liberty Radio Network, which is LRN.FM. And what I wanted to talk about today, and let's just jump right over there and be as clunky as possible in the transition here. I want to talk about a little bit. I don't want to focus on, I've said this before, I have no use for cop bashing, really. I really don't have any use for cop bashing. I view police the way I view a plumber or a hairstylist or, a roofer or anybody else. The individual is doing their job. They are hired to do a job. Whether they're good at it or whether they're bad at it has no reflection upon the industry. Each individual needs to be judged as an individual. And there's nothing necessarily about being a plumber or being a cop or being anything else that is necessarily good or evil. So I don't think it's useful, and I don't think it's fair to just do general cop bashing. Now, that said, I have done, three officially, three in the series of why a police state is inevitable. And my point in those podcasts was to point out that there are specific economic mechanisms that drive a society, that drive individuals within that society. Once you accept certain premise as being factual, and that specifically being that you can take a certain segment of the population, you can dress them up differently, you can give them symbols of authority like badges and separately painted cars, differently painted cars, uniforms, whatever. When you take people and you set them up like that, and this is the same with someone who is a judge and dresses up special so that we can honor them as a judge or anybody else in society, that you take and you dress them up in some kind of a costume and you place upon them false authority that all the other human beings do not have, and you allow them exceptions for their behavior. Even if it's only slightly different than the rest of the public, when you do this, anytime you do this, and it doesn't matter what the job title is or what the function is, when you do these things, you set up a guarantee that you're going to get certain results from doing this, whether it's in the criminal justice system or whether it's in, whether they're auto body painters. It doesn't matter what the profession is. When you create a formula like what I'm talking about, you are guaranteed to eventually, it will come to a point of where you get results that you did not intentionally want to begin with. And that's the case with the police system. Once you decide that you're going to take a segment of the population and you're going to give to them rights and powers and authority that nobody else in society has, and then you dress them up in a costume and you convince them that they have a certain responsibility and a certain authority that nobody else has, then you have guaranteed that you're going to move towards a police state. And this might be delayed by having wave after wave of very good people in the job. But ultimately, the good people are going to be pushed out, and the bad people will have positions of dominance, and eventually you will have a police state. And I'm not going to restate all of that. If you think I'm wrong or whatever, go listen to the three podcasts that I did on this topic, and see how I laid out the economic reasons as to why this is inevitable. But now, so I'm saying all that to say that it's not the individual cop that is the problem. It is a system and a process of it's the belief in the state. When you grasp in your mind and when you believe in your mind that it's legitimate to give some people in society authority that others don't have, that's the myth of the state. And when you adopt that in your mind as legitimate, then you set certain things as a guaranteed result. And so it's not that we have to attack police. It's not that we have to even attack the individual actions of police. What we need to do is work on the myth that good people believe, and those good people being, some of them being police, some of those good people being the people who support police, some of those people being the families of good police. All through society, the way to combat the evils that we see in police abuse and in authority abuse, or in judicial abuse, or in prosecutorial abuse, or in congressional abuse, and in legislative abuse, or presidential abuse. You know, a lot of people right now are stomping mad at Obama. But you shouldn't be. Obama is following exactly the pattern that any human being would follow, given all the steps, all the economic stimuli that have been laid out before him and his predecessors before him. He is simply responding in a way that is entirely predictable. And as much as some people may hate Obama right now, or as some people may have hated Baby Bush prior to Obama, or as much as some people hated Clinton prior to Baby Bush, or Papa Bush prior to that, or Reagan prior to that, as much as anybody might hate on any one of those individuals, what you're actually doing is missing the point, because it's not that individual. That individual is simply responding to the stimuli that are provided for them. So what we have to do is we have to remove the stimuli. We have to remove the thing within people's minds that make all that nonsense legitimate. And that's the real key. All right, now, so like 12, 15 minutes into the podcast, and I haven't even touched my notes yet. That's typical. So let's try to get back to the notes, shall we? Okay, so I wanted to bring up a news item, and I said everything I just said so that it didn't sound like I'm cop bashing when I read this news item, because I'm really not. I'm not making exceptions for the cops, for the individual cops that took these actions. I'm not making excuses for the individuals that took these actions. I'm not asking mercy on them in any way. Okay, so let's see if we can get into this now. And as I read this, again, not cop bashing, not defending the individuals, just we're dealing with a system here, a whole layers of a system that is seriously messed up. Okay, so this is from ABC News, and I'll put the link on the page where this podcast appears in the podcast notes, abcnews.go.com. And the story, the headline says, and what date is this? This is kind of old. I meant to get to this earlier, but I never got around to it. The date is April 4th, 2012. And let's see, this is from Kane Bordeaux of the Associated Press. And then, of course, ABC News just copies and pastes, because that's what all the big news people do. They don't actually have, you know. Anyway, not the point. Okay, so the headline reads, 5 ex-cops sentenced in Katrina killing case. I should mention, because my voice is going to collapse here momentarily, I've been having sinus problems all week and maybe a little bit of a head cold. I'm not sure exactly what's going on with that. So my voice may be in and out. And also, I'm in the middle of a text conversation on my phone, so that may I may be in and out of the in and out of the podcast on that as well. So, but you know what we don't have? I don't have the dog barking or the dog coming in here wanting to go out for a walk, and I don't have Baggy the cat. The dog being Nikki the dog. The two big dogs are in the backyard. They're fine. And I don't have Baggy the cat coming in trying to bat at the microphone. Okay, so let's get to this article, shall we? 5 ex-cops sentenced in Katrina killing case. A federal judge sentenced 5 former police officers to years in prison for the deadly shooting on a New Orleans bridge in the chaotic days following Hurricane Katrina, but not before lashing out at prosecutors for allowing others involved to serve lighter penalties for their crimes. The case that wrapped up Wednesday was the centerpiece of a Justice Department push to clean up New Orleans Police Department that has long been tainted with corruption. You think, really? Sorry, that part's not in the article. U.S. District Judge Kurt Englehart expressed frustration that he was bound by mandatory minimum sentencing laws to imprison former sergeants Kenneth Bowen and Robert I'm not even going to try it. Sorry, cop. And former officers Anthony, yeah, that guy, and Robert something or other for decades, when other officers who were engaged in similar conduct on the Danziger Bridge but cut deals with prosecutors are serving no more than 8 years behind bars. All right, let me stop on this just for a second, because this could just be the way this is written. And it may not actually express the intent of the judge, but the way this paragraph, the way these two paragraphs are written, is like the judge doesn't want to have to give such a harsh sentence to the cops in this case because the other cops got a lighter case. So rather than, then again, this could just be the way it's written, rather than actually judging each individual as an individual, he wants to judge the individual according to how the other individuals were judged. Well, that's stupid. That's not right. That's like two kids on a playground, on opposite sides of the playground, each engage in a fight separately that starts the fight. And so one teacher grabs the other, grabs one, and a different teacher grabs the other. You haul them both in to the office. One goes to the principal, one goes to the vice principal. The vice principal says you're expelled for a day. The principal tells the other student that was involved in an identical fight, I would like to suspend you for a day, but I can't because, no, how one person, if a person is guilty of a crime, they need to be dealt with specifically according to them as an individual and the crime that they did, not according to how somebody else judged some other case. That's entirely illegitimate. Now, again, that could just be the way that this is written, but on the other hand, the judge is expressing frustration that the system is such that his hands are tied as a judge with this stupid minimum sentencing stuff. So let me get back to the article here. This is the part I just read. U.S. Oh, no, I'm not going to try to re-pronounce all those names again. Okay, so I'll just continue with the article. This is quoting the judge. These through-the-looking-glass plea deals that tied the hands of this court are an affront to the court and a disservice to the community, he said. Police, oh, now it's going to the article. It's no longer quoting the judge. Police gunned down 17-year-old James Brissett and 40-year-old Ronald Madison, who were both unarmed, and wounded 4 others on September 4th, 2005, less than a week after the storm devastated New Orleans. To cover it up, the officers planted a gun, fabricated witnesses, and falsified reports. Defense attorneys have indicated that they will appeal. All right, now let me just talk about these scumbag defense attorneys first off. We have two people killed and several other people wounded as panicked, poorly trained cops, overinflated on their own authority, fired on people, not because they were evil cops or wanting to hurt somebody or kill somebody, but because they jumped to the conclusion that somebody wasn't bowing to their authority properly, and maybe those people coming at them were scary and dangerous, and so they can just decide to start shooting at them. Now, this is not necessarily because these cops are evil. It's because a whole series of things in their lives have provided for them in their minds the idea that they can do these actions and that it'll be okay. And then once the actions take place, again, layers and layers and layers of false authority placed upon them gives them the impression that they can then go and plant guns on these people and falsify. Now, something like this doesn't happen like once. Like you go through your whole life and everything's fine, and then you do something stupid one time, and then you have the ability to go into elaborate cover-up of it. It just people don't function that way. Here's who has the skill and the tendency to go through elaborate cover-ups. People who've done it before. So you can bet your bottom dollar this is not the first time that they planted evidence and altered witnesses and falsified report. You can bet your bottom dollar it's not the first time. And the judge himself actually acknowledged that corruption in the New Orleans Police Department is a well-known and well-documented thing, and it is. New Orleans is almost legendary for its corrupt police. It's right up there with Chicago and New York and L.A. And, you know, we could keep saying city names like that. And why is that? Is it just because it's a city? No, absolutely not. You can go way out in the country and find little police forces. Let me break off of this rant just for a second. Let me tell you about a police force that I have very close understanding of. When I was 17, 18, 19, when I was in that age group, the little tiny city in California that I lived in was probably less than 2,000 population, and there was an oversized police force there. And it was kind of odd to all the residents that we would have a police force that big, but nobody really did a big deal about it. There really wasn't any kind of serious crime in this little town way out in the middle of the Mojave Desert. There really wasn't any kind of serious crime. There was, kids now and then would do some stupid thing, or there would be some vandalism, or somebody would steal a radio or something. But it really wasn't any kind of big crime, center or anything like that. And oddly enough, the real criminals that were around in the area didn't have any kind of problems with the cops. And this included, how do you say this tactfully? Families, well-connected families of Sicilian ancestry who were involved in the, who owned wineries in Northern California and had hydroponic marijuana farms in greenhouses growing in the Mojave Desert. These individuals didn't have any kind of a problem with the local police. As a matter of fact, in one case where the sheriff's department, the Kern County Sheriff's Department, in conjunction with federal agencies, came out and made a major raid in the area, I know firsthand, because I know the people who witnessed it, the local police actually drove out and warned the people at their headquarters that the raid was about to take place in the next hour or so, and so they all scattered to try to get out of there before the police, before the sheriff and the feds actually showed up to bust them. So we're talking about a small little police force here, way out in the middle of nowhere in a tiny little town, and the mayor was absolutely corrupt. The chief of police was absolutely corrupt. It was so bad in this little town that the fire chief was literally using the fire chief's car to transport drugs. This is late 70s. Now, I'm not going to get into this story in depth. The whole purpose in bringing this up, and this is something maybe I can talk about it another time if there's interest in hearing more details on it, but my purpose in bringing this up is to point out that the deep levels of corruption that were in and are still in the New Orleans Police Department and are in the Chicago Police Department and that are in New York Police Department and that are in Los Angeles Police Department, these very, very well-known cases of corruption in these big cities are not the exception, and it's not because it's a big city. It's because the concept that you can separate some people, I might as well repeat it, you can separate some people out from among society and costume them up and give them authority that no one else has. And even at this point, half an hour into the podcast, if you think that police don't have authority that no one, if you think, oh no, there's cross-checking, oh no, we stand to a higher standard even than the regular public, really? How come I can't flash my lights at somebody, pull them over, and search their car? And you say, oh, we can't search without probable cause. Come on, probable cause is anything. What does that mean, probable cause? It means anything you think is a good reason. And we've seen this before in case after case, the one that I quoted the other day on a podcast where they bring out a dog that is trained specifically for the handler to let the dog flag any car that the handler wants to flag. There's, all right, so I've already gotten way off the topic. Tell you what, let's break and we'll throw in our commercial here. And then when we get back from the commercial, I'll pick the story back up and try to stay on the story and not rant in every other direction. How would you like to support badquaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks.
This is the Central Scrutinizer. We're working very hard to spend your tax money to keep you from hearing things like freedomfiends.com. That's why we're very upset about freedomfiends.cz. Freedomfiends.cz is a Liberty Media archive of Freedom Fiends material hosted in the Czech Republic. Freedomfiends.cz is outside the jurisdiction of the Watchers, who employ me, the Central Scrutinizer, to keep you from hearing things that might make you think. My fellow scrutinizers and I do not want you to visit freedomfiends.cz. Do not visit freedomfiends.cz.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And let's see if I can get back to the story here and not rambling on about back in my day, we used to have cops. Okay, let's see. And I read that part. And it says, to cover it up, the officers planted a gun, fabricated witnesses, and falsified reports. And the defense attorneys have indicated that they will appeal because they're scumbag attorneys and all they care about is keeping the thing perpetually in a state of appeal so that they can continue to get paid. Englehart, I'm back to reading the article now, Englehart also criticized prosecutors for the different ways they charged those who didn't cooperate with the Justice Department's civil rights investigation and those who did. The charges were filed in such a way that they left judges with little discretion in handing out sentences in each of the cases, Englehart said. Let's touch on that really quick. So in other words, amazingly, so the cops gave the... No, let me back that up. So the prosecutors gave the police involved choices. They said, you can cooperate with the investigation and we'll go light on you, or you cannot cooperate and we'll go harsh on you. Now, this, there's a moral problem here. Let's say, do I even want to get into that? You know, if a person shoots an innocent person, does it really help the victims or the family of the victims whether or not the shooter was nice to the prosecutor or not, or whether the shooter made the prosecutor's job easier or not? Should that really affect the outcome of what is justice, whether or not the shooter was friendly with the prosecutor, or whether the shooter made the prosecutor's job easier or harder? Should that affect justice? Should justice be based on the convenience of the prosecutor? Is there any logic to that? Yet that's exactly the system we have in the United States. And the judge here sees that, is frustrated by it, and can't do a thing about it. Well, I wonder why that is. Judge, as you're complaining, Judge Englehart, as you're complaining about this, realize this is the law. This is what you're sworn to uphold. This is exactly the process that you cling to. Yet you yourself, Judge Englehart, and I use that phrase loosely considering that I don't actually call people by titles like that, you so-called Judge Englehart, the very thing that you're complaining about is the system that you embrace yourself. That you, like a leech, suck your lifeblood from society while propping up this system, Englehart. That's the system you support, you individual person, Englehart. Until all of these people on all levels realize that this stupid myth of the state is horribly destructive and can never bring justice, then this nonsense will just get worse and worse and worse until, and here's the ultimate end. And I'll jump right to the punchline of this, to the cut to the chase, so to speak. The ultimate end of this is that the injustice of the justice system slowly becomes more and more and more obvious to more and more and more people living within the confines of the borders of the United States of America. And at some point, a saturation point is reached. And when that takes place, you're talking about a people who have been systematically abused by the so-called justice system. And all the time, their hopes and their beliefs have all been based upon this false reality. And when you pop that bubble, And when it comes home to people's minds that all of this is nothing but pure corruption and there is no justice in the justice system, and when enough abuse takes place and enough excuses are made by enough of these judges and attorneys and cops and every other level of government that supports this myth of the state, when enough of the general public realizes the fakeness of all this and the injustice of all this, you're going to have a really, really nasty Russian Revolution type, French Revolution type situation. We're not talking about something here like where in the Philippines when the Marcos family was overthrown and all they do is just have a nice friendly election and vote them out. When you really take major cities like New Orleans, Los Angeles, Chicago, Detroit, New York, when you take cities like that and it starts to dawn on large segments of the population that they cannot have and they will not ever have justice from the existing system, you are going to have a problem like you cannot imagine. And there is only one way to diffuse this, and that is to begin to realize and to begin to share with others the falsity of this belief in the state. And as people actually within the system, as people like this judge, like this Engelhardt, and his prosecutors begin to realize the falseness of what it is that they do, that they as individuals are doing, and what the wrong that they're doing upon society by continuing to stay in the system. And as individual police officers open their eyes and stop making excuses for this system and realize that they're perpetuating this, when that starts to happen, and individual police officers and individual attorneys and individual judges begin to pull out of the system, then we're going to start moving towards a legitimacy, and more people will begin to see it. And this whole thing can evaporate without the kind of French Revolution-like situations. Now, I'm saying all that, and if you're a regular listener to my podcast, I've talked before about when the state starts to die, what things are going to be like. And if you want to see what the state is like when it's going to when it gets to the point of where it starts to die, you look at any violent animal, an animal that is a predatory type animal. Let me give you an example. When I was a kid, a lot of us rode dirt bikes out in the middle of the desert. And in California, a good portion of the state is desert. So this is not only in the Mojave Desert, where I lived for a considerable amount of time, but also in the other deserts down in Southern California and even up into the San Joaquin Valley. You get out, run around on your motorcycle, and one of the popular things to do back in those days was to chase a jackrabbit. Now, it may seem like a really cruel thing to do, but it's kind of a part of a jackrabbit's life to occasionally take off and go on a merry chase and lose the predator that's chasing him. So as a dirt biker and as a stupid kid out in the middle of the Mojave Desert, oftentimes people would chase a jackrabbit a little bit. I took some pretty nasty crashes from jackrabbits because in trying to chase them, they're actually a lot smarter than you would think. And a jackrabbit that's been chased a couple times knows how to ditch a biker pretty quickly. So I learned that in the battle between the dirt bikers and the jackrabbits, it's best to leave the jackrabbits to their profession. But some people that I knew, and I never did this, but some people I knew like to find coyotes and try to chase coyotes. Now, the difference in a jackrabbit and a coyote, when you chase a jackrabbit, he'll take off running, and he'll make some quick moves to try to get away from you. And if you stick with him through those quick moves, he'll take off on a long, hard, straight run and let you catch right up to him. And then he'll either disappear behind a quick move to one side or the other where there's no possible way you can turn that quick. Or he'll bring you right towards one of the big washes that's in the desert. And if you're not familiar, a wash is like a dry creek bed in the desert, except the water has come through so quickly that it has cut sheer like miniature cliffs on each side of the bed of what would be the creek bed. So you can be, if you're not careful riding through the desert, you can be riding along and all of a sudden you get to one of these washes and you're facing anywhere from a 10 to maybe a 30 foot cliff. And if you're not careful, you just shoot right off of that thing. Well, jackrabbits will actually bait you into chasing them right at one of those things. And then they'll drop over the edge of the cliff and into a hole that's actually in the side of the cliff. And if you're not careful, you shoot right off that cliff on your bike and you're going down hard. Well, that's what jackrabbits will do because they're smart. Now, coyotes have a different policy. A coyote seeing a dirt biker coming at him, the coyote will attempt to sort of jog away. He's not going to try to run hard because a coyote conserves his hard running strength for when he's really hungry and he needs a kill. So he'll start sort of jogging away from you to try to get away from you. And he'll make a couple efforts to turn and go different directions. But eventually, if you keep messing with that coyote, when he realizes that you're out after him, he stops running and he'll turn around and face you. And if you're not real careful, you're going to have a problem on your hands with an angry coyote. Now, that's just one example, and that's not even a coyote that's near death. That's just a coyote that you've irritated. Now, this might be a similar thing. I've seen this with coyotes. I've never actually done that to a coyote because I think they're pretty cool and I would never want to do that to one. But this is similar to what a hunter might face when he's, say, up in the Canada or in Alaska or something, and he runs across a bear and he shoots the bear. And the bear, or any other really powerful predator like that, when you shoot and injure an animal, specifically one that's a predator, if you haven't killed it, you have a very dangerous animal on your hands. And if you need to go in closer and actually make the kill on that animal, you're taking a serious risk because that guy, he's not going to go down easy. He's going to do everything he can to take you with him. And this is how I equate the state. Now, at some point in time, I'm gonna have to do more on my article on the nature of the state and try to tie these things together in some kind of a logical pattern to show that we can understand the nature of the state, therefore we can predict the behavior of the state when the state starts to fall. And as I've said before, the state will thrash out. The state will violently attack its own followers. Now, it'll attack those who are against the state as well if it can find us. And that's going to be our responsibility to be invisible to the state. That's the way we fight the state, is to become invisible to the state. In underground markets and agora and everything that I've talked about before, if we're doing all these things in an entirely invisible, we can be right among the population and yet invisible to the state. If we're doing that, when the state starts to die and it starts to realize it's dying, when it thrashes out, it'll thrash out at anybody it can find, and it's only going to find the supporters of the state. And if you look at the history of Nazi Germany in the last moments, who was being executed? The Germans were not lining up the general population. They weren't lining up old ladies on the street killing them. They were lining up their generals and their colonels and their majors. That's who they were executing. Now, and that's aside from the poor people that were in the concentration camps. They were killing them as quickly as possible as well. But that was predictable, considering once they start rounding up people into those camps, that's the inevitable result anyway. But that's beside the point. But the state itself, as in the moments before the state died in Nazi Germany, its reaction was to kill the very top people that held it together. And you can look back at Rome, and we can talk about emperors killing their own staff, and we can talk about the Praetorian Guard turning on the emperor himself. We can talk about other times. We can talk about the French Revolution and how the king's guards themselves, or we can talk about the Russian Revolution. As you look at these situations, what you have a tendency to see is that in those last moments, when the state really thrashes out, it puts its worst anger upon its strongest supporters. So for the case of this judge, in the case of the of police, who are good police and good prosecutors and good attorneys and good judges and good lawmakers, you need to realize that that thing that you support, that thing that you believe in, is the very thing that's going to devour you and your families if you don't separate yourself from it and get away from it. All right, let me try to take this back to the story and wrap it up before I run out of time here. Okay, getting back to the story, it says, it names one of the police involved, Falcone, F-A-U-L-C-O-N. That's one of the officers. And it lists each of these officers. I'm not going to attempt to do their names, so I'll paraphrase this whole paragraph here. One of the officers got 65 years in prison, two others got 40 years each, and another got 38 years. All four were convicted of federal firearms charges that carry mandatory minimum sentences ranging from 35 to 60 years in prison. Only one was actually convicted of the deadly shootings. That's the guy that got the 65 years. The court imposes them purely as a matter of statutory mandate, Englehart said. So in other words, the judge is saying he had no choice. This was what he had to issue. Well, what good does it have what good is it to have a judge if the judge cannot judge? If the judge has no capability of judging, how is he a judge? This is stupid. And as government continues to get older and older in the United States, as long as it is supported by this mythical state, government will get stupider and stupider and stupider. Okay, retired Sergeant Arthur Archie Kaufman, who was assigned to investigate the shootings, received 6 years in prison, a sentence below the federal guidelines. Kaufman wasn't charged in the shootings, but was convicted of helping orchestrate the cover-up. Now, here's a fun little thing. Let me just touch on this for a second. Retired Sergeant Arthur Archie Kaufman, who was assigned to investigate the shootings, received 6 years in prison, which is below the federal guidelines. How did he get that? He cut a plea deal. Not only did he cut a plea deal, he was allowed to retire before he got his conviction. So when he gets out, when he serves he probably won't even serve the whole 6 years. Whoever serves all their time anyway in an American prison? Well, some might, but I'll bet he won't. So after he serves whatever he serves of his 6 year sentence, he gets to come out and enjoy all his full retirement because he was allowed to retire before he got the conviction. Wasn't that convenient of the cop who actually orchestrated the falsifying of the information? The investigator who was asked to investigate this and falsified the information is the one that only gets 6 years and he gets his full retirement. Isn't that a sweet deal? During a scathing lecture that lasted roughly 2 hours, Englehart questioned the credibility of officers who cut deals and testified against the defendants during the trial. This is an Englehart quote. He says, "Citing witnesses for perjury at this trial would have been like handing out speeding tickets at the Indianapolis 500. Justice Department attorney Bobby Bernstein defended prosecutors' tactics, saying the officers who cooperated with the probe gave them the breakthrough they needed to reveal the cover-up. In other words, cops ratted out the cops." Well, isn't that amazing? Police who are listening to this, you need to realize that your fellow police that you defend so regularly, given the opportunity, they'll sell you down the river, as the folks used to say in the old 30s movies. They will sell you down the river. They will sing like a canary. they will put you away. Because when the rubber meets the road and it really gets to the point, I wonder if I could put any more metaphors in that. When it really gets to the point of where they're looking at hard time in prison, they will cut a deal. Now, cops, if there's even one cop left, I know there used to be a couple cops that listened to this podcast, but I don't know if there are any left at all. And I hope there are. I hope a good cop listens to this and hears what I'm trying to say, and hears that I'm not trying to condemn him or condemn any specific cop. But I'm saying this, that cops are like any other human. They're just like the plumber. They're just like any other human. And put into the right situation, they will, and given the opportunity, bad cops will lie about good cops to take the heat off themselves and to spread that heat out so that you take part of their blame. If you're a good cop, you need to realize that you need to get out of it. Completely separate yourself from it. Get yourself a real job that doesn't depend on the theft of taxes from innocent people. Get out of it. Get a morally correct job and realize the error of your ways. Because at some point in time, the system's going to fall apart. And those supporters of it, whether they be good or bad, they're the ones that are going to suffer. So get out of it, please. It's for all of us. And it's for you too. Those deals, this is back to what this prosecutor says, those deals are the reason that the whole world now knows what happened on the Danziger Bridge. Oh, she said. I didn't realize Bobby Bernstein was a female. If I said he, I apologize. The sentences were significantly lower than what prosecutors had recommended. They had asked the judge to sentence the four shooters to prison terms ranging from nearly 60 years to 87 years for one of the people. I'm not going to try his name. Now, the story goes on from there, and I'm not going to keep reading it because it's like 3 pages long. I wanted to get past that so that you understood the severity of this and the corruption. The corruption level, even among the ones that are following the law, the ones that are doing everything that the law allows, which includes the prosecutors and the cops that are ratting each other out, each one of those is following the process and doing, nobody's breaking the law and doing this. When one cop gets 8 years and another gets 60 some years, no one's breaking the law and doing that. And as much as the judge wants to stomp his little feet and pound his little fists on his desk and cry like a little baby, the fact is, this is the system that he swore allegiance to. This is the system that he supports. It's the system that he says is law, and he says civilization will fall apart without it. When in fact, this is the actual system that has the potential of destroying civilization. So then, I hate to do it, but this takes me back to a statement. This takes me back to something I've been saying over and over. What part of the Constitution is it that you don't like? Remember that? If you're a regular listener to BadQuaker.com podcast, you'll know I was quoting that. I think it was the last podcast. I quoted that a few times. What part of the Constitution is it that you don't like? To establish justice. If we don't have justice, any society, if you don't have justice, you will not have domestic tranquility. To establish justice, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. Well, you know what? If you don't have justice, the whole game stops. There will be no domestic tranquility. Domestic tranquility is entirely dependent upon justice. When the people do not have justice, there will not be domestic tranquility. And what is the opposite? The opposite is exactly what we're headed for. Now, again, I want to just make a distinction here. There are two sources of massed violence that the United States of America faces in the future. One is violence from the government upon its people, and the other is the violence of the people upon the people. You see, because the people, if they turn on the government, well, that's revolution, and governments know exactly how to handle that. Just ask the people living in Egypt right now. Yeah, ask the people living in Libya. How'd your revolution go? You feel good right now? You feel safe? You feel free? Revolution is not the answer. When people attempt to turn on their government, governments just crush the people. And even if the people win the revolution, the government, they immediately form a new government. And the new government comes in worse than the old. This has happened over and over and over through history. Don't repeat the same stupid patterns over and over. Learn from them. Revolution is not the answer. Revolution just creates a nastier, stronger government than what you had to begin with. And typically, it's the same, give or take a few heads of state or give or take a few top people like that. Generally, the same, ultimately, you get the second or third tier people from the first government that become the top tier of the second government. So you haven't really done anything other than replace one leader for another leader, and you have more tyranny right on top of you. So what is the answer to all this? The answer is not revolution. The answer is to try to defuse a revolution before it happens, so that when the state falls, people recognize that they didn't really need that thing to begin with. And that's the message that spreads. And that way, when states start to crumble, when individual governments start to crumble, and then eventually the state starts to crumble, when the time comes that people are prepared enough for this in their minds, and they understand how to deal with this, and they understand that we're all better off when that myth dies, then at that point in time, and this may be, you know, many generations away, I'm not expecting any of this to happen in our lifetime. I'm expecting the actual United States government to collapse maybe in my lifetime or maybe in my children's lifetime. I don't know how this goofy, debt-ridden government can support itself much longer. But that's not the state. That's not the state. That's just one government. And so when the real worldwide, when the governments of the world begin to unite under one state, one government, and when that one state begins to die, as many of us that are left that recognize what this is and share what it is with other people and don't try to fight it, we fight it on our battlefields, on using the weapons that are to our advantage, and that means peace, freedom, love for one another, peaceful trade, peaceful exchange, embracing the zero aggression principle. These things the state can't understand, and it can't battle them. So as we do these things quietly in the underground, and as the state grows bigger and more hideous, and individual governments like the one in the U.S. collapse and form new governments, North American governments or NATO governments or UN governments or whatever, eventually they'll all collapse. And when they do, we will have the answer to that, and we will bring it about peaceably. And we won't need to amass armies, and we won't need to have a revolution, and we won't need to fight the state according to the battlefields and the weapons of the state. Those things are all unproductive. Okay, so I hope that was somewhat coherent. I didn't get even halfway through my notes, but, anyway, thanks for listening. For more on the Zero Aggression Principle, property rights, and liberty, I said it backwards that time, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much, folks. Bye.